run. Earlier, his brother Tamerlan, who was also a suspect, was shot dead by police. Razan Sani has made an appeal to his nephew.
I say, Johar, if you're alive, turn yourself in and ask for forgiveness from the victims, from the injured.
Large parts of Boston are in lockdown. Public transport systems are shut and people are being urged to stay indoors. Health officials have confirmed a 25-year-old man who died in Swansea did have measles, but Public Health Wales says further tests are being carried out to establish the actual cause of his death. More than 800 cases of measles have been confirmed in the Swansea area. The husband of a woman who died in an Irish hospital after being refused an abortion has labelled her treatment inhumane. An inquest has ruled Savita Halapanova died as a result of a medical misadventure at a hospital in Galway. Her widower, Praveen, says she'd have survived if she'd had been given a termination.
Medicine is all about improving patients' life and health. And look what they did. She was just left there to die.
The jury made 9 recommendations, including better guidelines on legal abortion. GlaxoSmithKline has been accused of undermining competition. GSK is alleged to have paid 3 drugs companies not to launch cheap versions of antidepressants. It denies any wrongdoing. That's the latest. I'm Matt Steele.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, the Green Party are in Mayor Ferguson's cabinet, but Labour aren't. Gus Hoyt will be here to explain exactly what he's doing for us and his party. Well, it looks like we were right about this year's Bilderberg meeting. Reports this week strongly suggest the Western Mafia dons are meeting in June in, wait for it, Watford. If you haven't heard of this private club of royalty, bankers, oil chiefs, arms manufacturers, media, including, of course, the BBC, and the super-rich Bilderbergers, then you soon will, we hope. Bombs at the finish line and further developments today. So, is this blowback for America's war on Islam in Boston? Or is there another agenda? 20 years ago today, the 2-month siege of the Branch Davidians community in Waco, Texas, came to a horrific end as Bradley tanks closed in on David Koresh in his Texas settlement. 76 people were killed, including 20 children. About the same number that died yesterday in the fertilizer plant explosion, just outside Waco. We revisit those events. Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's 2 weekend weather forecasts from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 and some light rain. This weekend, highs of 13 Celsius, sunny tomorrow, slightly more cloudy on Sunday. Highs of 16 Celsius next week, a fairly sunny week, maybe clouding over with some light rain towards the end of the week. Oh, spring's finally here. Next weekend, that's the 27th and the 28th of April, highs of 13, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's 2 weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is the Conservative MP for Henbury, sorry, MP, Councillor. In fact, you're not quite an MP yet, Mark, are you? and that's Mark Weston. Hi, Mark. Welcome to Drive Time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, as deputy leader of the Conservatives on Bristol City Council, what does that actually entail? Are you just deputising for Jeff Gollop, is that right?
No, our leader is Peter Abrahams.
Oh, okay.
Jeff is on the cabinet.
So why isn't your leader on the cabinet?
Well, it's obviously when the mayor was elected, he didn't have a party to draw on. So he obviously approached all the parties, including Labour, which you touched on earlier, and basically asked us to fill his cabinet. And it was felt that in order for the Conservatives and the other parties to retain their sort of independence, that the leaders wouldn't go on. Because that way we're lending our support, we're lending our expertise, but at the same time we're retaining our own identity. So, for example, Jeff is an accountant by trade, and he's in charge of the money which actually, if you're going to put someone in charge of the money, then it should be an accountant. So that makes a certain kind of sense there. So, no, our leader's Peter Abrahams, and when he's unavailable to lead our group, things like that, then yes, I'll be deputising for him.
Okay, Thatcher's funeral this week, Margaret Thatcher's funeral, wasn't it just a giant party political broadcast to take, really, £10 million of taxpayers' money?
No, not remotely, and I find that quite offensive. No, whether you love or hate Margaret Thatcher, and let's face it, there were some displays of the latter. She was a remarkable and determined woman. She was Prime Minister for 11 years, and I think she deserves our respect, and she deserves a good funeral, and she was given a good send-off, and I think we did a very good, damn good job, and I think she deserved it.
But why didn't, say, for example, Harold Wilson deserve that kind of send-off?
I can't answer that. Different age, I'm afraid. And
isn't this something that the establishment and the Queen really decides these things? Is that what you know, would you?
Well, it kind of is. I mean, I find it ironic actually that the person that drew up the plans for this funeral were Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. So I find it slightly strange that some on the left are gnashing their teeth when actually it was the left that drew it up. No, I don't know why Harold Wilson didn't. I certainly wouldn't put him, though, in the same category as Margaret Thatcher, but I'd imagine there are those that would think the opposite of that. No, I think she deserved it, and I think she was a damn good Prime Minister, and we should venerate her memory.
I mean, Clement Attlee, after the Second World War, rebuilt Britain, or war-torn Britain. Mm. Apparently only 150 people, a very small funeral he had.
And actually, I think that is a shame, because I don't agree with everything Clement Attlee did, but I do rate him and his reform, so that's a real shame.
I think for a lot of people, they do see this as a sort of establishment, you know, Tory party funeral. And also, there are people saying that Thatcherism is actually continuing, is that the Tories are doing very well for themselves and for their own, you know, establishment people, but the rest of us are sort of left to just get on with things.
No, I don't buy that one at all, I'm afraid. Look at what's happening at the moment. The wealthiest portion of society are paying more in tax now than they ever did under the Labour government, at any point under the Labour government, whereas actually we're lifting thousands of people, millions of people, out of tax altogether by increasing the tax thresholds. So I'm not buying that. If you look at the breakdown, you look at the statistics, the wealthy are paying more. Now, this obviously gets confused with the 50p tax and everything else like that, but it has to be remembered that the top rate of tax now is 45%. Under Labour, for all bar 1 month, it was 40%. No, the wealthy are paying their way, they're paying more than they've ever done before, and I find that kind of a dogma very misguided.
Okay, but the OIC, which is apparently what it used to be called at Eton, George Osborne, doesn't actually know what he's doing, does he? I mean, we've had the IMF this week putting pressure on George Osborne, basically saying that, this is Larry Elliott in The Guardian, George Osborne is under mounting pressure to moderate his austerity strategy after the IMF went public with fears that the pace of budget cuts is far too severe for Britain's ailing economy. The fund said it would be holding talks with the Chancellor about his tax and spending plan in the wake of a gloomy forecast that subjected the UK to the biggest growth downgrade of any developed country for 2013 and 2014. Now, essentially, he's down at Eton, isn't he? And he's been called into the headmaster's office.
No, I'm sorry, I'm not going to buy that. You're reading straight out of an extract from The Guardian, so it's not exactly a balanced newspaper. But you're also looking at the report from Tuesday. If you look at what Lagarde said yesterday, the head of the IMF, she said, and I quote on this, "We clearly support the policy, the austerity policy." Now, what she then said is, if growth remains weak, then it's possible that you should slow down the austerity. But that is happening already. That, in fact, has been happening for a while. So I'm afraid, no, I'm not buying that. That's one economist out of the IMF that's singled Britain out individually. But actually, Lagarde clearly said yesterday that the IMF supports the policy. And I think if you read The Guardian, that would probably have been ignored today.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, time to bring you in here. I imagine okay, that you will agree with The Guardian line here.
Well, I think that let's just change the terms of the debate here. The IMF, frankly, have been wrong about virtually everything, in my view, for the last 30 or 40 years, so their opinion about this is not really worth much. I think from George Osborne's point of view, and the ruling class as a whole, if you like, they're starting to lose their nerve about austerity, as they should, because, of course, it's not going to work. And I don't think it'd be that much different if we had a new Labour government in power, because the problem is that the banking system is, in fact, it's completely dysfunctional, and tinkering at the edges is not actually going to change very much.
But would it be any different if Ed Miliband was in charge?
Probably not, because as Mark's just pointed out, austerity has been gradually drawn back. The original plan for the austerity hasn't worked, and of course, tax receipts have gone down as the economy's gone down, and benefit payments have gone up, and that's what happens. And in actual fact, what we are on is a sinking ship with nobody in charge on the.
One of the main reasons for that, Martin, is Gordon Brown and his bailout back in 2008. That's caused a massive, massive spike in our national debt, which is never going to be repaid. Well, there's no way that enough money is going to come in tax to repay that debt.
Can I come into this one? I think we need to be very clear when we're having this argument. There is a distinction between debt and deficit.
Yeah, I'm talking about the actual fundamental debt.
No, yeah, but you need... There was a spike in debt when the bailout went in, absolutely. But the biggest danger to Britain is actually an ongoing massive deficit. That is the one that will have the increasing impact, because a debt is a one-off hit. Deficit as a continual process is a risk.
I'm not trying to make party political points here. We're trying to abstract some kind of rational discussion out of this.
Why be different?
Standard and Poor's and Moody's and all of these ratings agencies have actually started to mark down Britain's debt, which was always ostensibly what the policy was about, was to prevent that happening. Actually, those people don't matter too much. They're the people who created the crisis in the first place. Exactly. But the point is that the situation, frankly, is far worse than any mainstream politician is prepared to actually confront the British people with. And it's not just the British people, it's the world economy, with Britain at the centre of it and the City of London at the centre of it, is in free fall. And it's about to fall off a cliff.
Mark,
and nobody is actually facing
Mark,
up
to be
it.
Fair, whatever the deficit is, we're looking at a projected public debt, national debt, in 2015 coming up towards 1.3, 1.4 trillion. And it's going up and up and up. If you look at the graph, it is literally almost directly up now. It's gone up logarithmically over the last, five, six, 7 years.
Not going to deny that at all. But this is the problem which I think Ed Miliband and his cronies and those on the left need to look at. Is I have them come to me and they sit there going, the level of debt is still rising. Well, of course it is. In 2010... you had a government income of 541 billion and a government expenditure of 700 billion. You have 159 billion deficit. Now, the problem, unless you're going to cut 159 billion deficit overnight, which no one would do, that would be, well, you couldn't do it. But if you were not, unless you're going to do that overnight, then the debt level is always going to go up. What you have to do is reduce the deficit level over time, slow the rate of which the debt level goes up, and then try and get it on an even keel. You can't do it overnight. Anyone that says you can, of the right or the left, is bonkers.
That's quite right. And I think the problem that you've got is there's a tactical level at which we're talking about this, and the deficit, in fact, is out of control. Because the economy hasn't picked up in the way that you might have hoped, the deficit is sliding out of control. But as you're quite right, nobody's facing up to the fact that the debt carries on rising, not just in Britain, but all over the world, because we're bailing out a bankrupt financial system. And as we saw in Cyprus, a tiny little country, if that bailout hadn't gone through, the banking system, the one that you get your money out of on the high street in Bristol, could have gone down the drain. And that's how serious the situation is. The wealthy classes are in looting money. Frankly, the banks have been given loads of money by the taxpayer and by the drug cartels to keep the system afloat. They can't do anything with it apart from gamble with it, and at the end of the day, that is going to turn to a crash.
But Martin,
and a crash is going to turn into a completely different
situation. The reason this is happening is because of this disastrous bailout in 2008. Well, the banks should have been allowed to collapse like any other business would that had gone bankrupt, and then we wouldn't be in this situation now, would we?
Well, that's a very interesting point you make there. Because, of course, the von Mises Institute and the real serious free market thinkers made exactly that point. Now, nobody across the whole of the mainstream political spectrum was prepared to contemplate what is the free market textbook, which is let them go down. But once you have bailed them out, you've actually got a nationalised banking system. The question is, who's in charge of it?
On that, actually, you may well be right. Maybe the banks should have been allowed to go, but maybe or maybe not. But what would the situation have been had they gone?
Well, I totally. These are the kind of rational arguments that we need to have.
This is what you need to have, because if the banking system had just collapsed, then there would have been a serious, serious problem.
Haven't we only
just shunted that down the road, Mark?
Well, no, but possibly. But what you've actually given is time to heal, and we can't overstate we shouldn't overstate the banking in Cyprus. Cyprus is a small
yes,
country.
But my point, but we have to look
at Martin, let him finish.
Yeah. You have to look at what happens. If Cyprus goes, well, Greek banks go, and those are holding Greek, because obviously Cypriot debt is primarily actually because they bailed out Greek debt.
Yes.
What happens then? Western European banks, well, if they have any sense, and I realise that a banker having sense is possibly an oxymoron at this point, they would have been writing down, should we call it Mediterranean debt, over the last few years. You give them time to do that. That's why we're increasing capitalisation requirements and things like that. You've got to give it time to heal. If the banks had been allowed to collapse, then the world would have been instantaneous disaster without any time to heal. It'd be equivalent to severing a limb off without.
So you do agree with Gordon Brown's policy of bailing them out then, effectively? As I do, reluctantly.
Reluctantly, yeah. I don't see an alternative. I'm a free marketeer, but actually, had the banks collapsed, I think letting one bank go, maybe Northern Rock or something.
Yeah, but you can't contain it.
You know, but look, yes, so I was about to say, look what happened with Lehman's. Lehman's went, and suddenly everything started to tumble.
But from my point of view, once you've accepted that the banking system, which is probably the most expensive thing to bail out of all, I mean, this is why the public sector debt has gone up all over the world. We're not just bailing out a crummy steel industry here. This is potentially, you know, astronomical amounts of money. And we basically, I mean, with Ben Bernanke saying that we'll pump any amount of money into the system, and we've now got a situation where the stock market is as high as it was before the crash, and the economy is going the opposite direction. That is crash territory.
If we're going to have an intellectual argument, then we also need to look at one of the inherent problems we've got, which actually comes back to the deficit and the debt. Okay, if the banks collapse, then the markets will have nowhere. You'd have market freefall. You would have a serious problem. You would not be able to have governments finding money on the markets because the markets would have lost all
faith. They'd have to reform the currency, wouldn't they?
Well, you'd have to totally do, but you'd have the Eurozone collapse. You would have economic anarchy. You would. And maybe you want that. Maybe that's a Darwinian approach. Maybe you want that. But
isn't that a free market approach?
No. But yeah, it is. But you've got to look at what happens to people. This isn't just going to affect the wealthy. This will crush the little guy to a point that he may not even recover. No. Now, if the government had sound financial footings, if it didn't have massive debt or deficit levels, if it was the master of its own ship, then it's possible they could ride it out by some fairly minor, relatively minor, currency tweaks. But you can't, because the government needs to raise hundreds of billions of pounds every year. Then you can't do it.
But Mark, the government has actually nationalised large parts of the banking sector. Surely the government is in the driving seat right now, and it's not actually using its public. Basically, the Treasury could be telling these banks what to do and getting them into shape, but it's not.
If I were the Treasury, I'd break the banks up and float them again. I don't think we should be dealing with the nationalised banks. I think one of the problems we have in the banking sector at the moment is too little competition.
But isn't the problem that they were in the private sector and actually just making money? They weren't interested in their public responsibilities.
They are basically nationalised at the moment, and we're not reaping a benefit from them. So as far as I'm concerned, they should be put back into private sector. We should try and recoup as much of the money as we can out of it. I realise it won't be a lot, but I'd break them in two. If you look at the money they hold on their balance sheets, some of these are now too big to fail, and banks have to be able to fail if there's going to be any competition in the market. We need to reintroduce some more competition. The banks should be put back into private sector. They should be broken up.
Yeah, well, the problem with this is it's stable door horse bolted.
Yeah.
You're not going to be able to put them back in the private sector because they're bust. I mean, Northern Rock is still worth less than it was when it was nationalised. And we're not. That's not going to change in an economy which is going down the drain here and elsewhere in the world. At some point, the market does work. The market, you know, actually the way the market works is the same for a left winger or a right winger, and it's not actually a question of ideology.
I can't believe you're admitting this on air.
No, of course I'm admitting this on air. In actual fact, the argument in favour of socialism is that capitalism doesn't work, and in actual fact we've rescued the banking system, but the banking system is not rescuable, and the idea that bringing more competition into the situation would solve the problem is frankly fantasy economics of the 1980s. Ultimately, certain things are such on such a big scale that they can't be run as a competitive industry, and that's why you don't run them as a competitive industry. And at the end of the crisis, we probably will have a nationalised banking system.
I find it quite ironic. Sorry, just a slight aside. I find it quite ironic that you say socialism is a response because capitalism doesn't work, and I would argue the complete reverse. We have capitalism because socialism doesn't work.
Well, no, we haven't even tried socialism.
That's because it doesn't work.
We haven't tried it because some people don't want it.
What about this idea of the Treasury, the government running banking as a utility, just to facilitate the real economy? Because it seems that we've got obsessed with this kind of investment bankers casino economy.
Actually, I do think it's time to go back to some good, honest banking. Because this is one of the problems. If the banks collapse, everyone just gets their paychecks, they go into the bank. What if you can't get your money out? You can't buy your food. And this is the problem. This is what they had almost in Cyprus. That's why £1 million in euros was flown over in notes to the RAF bases there. So, I actually would like to see a return to the traditional high street lending.
Splitting casino banking from retail banking, for example, which was always the case until liberalisation in the 90s.
No, I'd be fine with that.
Well, they're saying they're going to do this in 5 years' time. I mean, you know, that's a long way down the road. They're not doing it quick enough.
No, hold on. You're talking about cutting companies in two with very complicated economic fingers and pies. You can't do it overnight. You've got to do it carefully. Otherwise, you may well end up threatening the financial institutions you're trying to save.
Martin, could you do it within five years?
But well, I think the problem is any attempt to reform the financial sector, whether it's by legal means, for example, prosecuting people, which is definitely being talked about, or by breaking banks up to create more competition, it's such a fragile system that any attempt to do that will make it crash, because it's going to crash anyway.
That's why you need 5 years.
Well, we haven't got 5 years. I think there's going to be a crash before the end of this year, and the politics of this country and every country are going to be very, very different afterwards.
You heard it here first on the 19th of April. No.
I've been predicting this for a long time, because in actual fact, in my view, if there is no way out of this now, somebody somewhere is going to pull the final piece out of the Jenga pile, and it's going to go down. And on the other side of that, people will start to ask themselves serious questions about who has the wealth and power in society.
But Martin, you've been saying this for the last couple of years.
I've been saying it all my life.
What may be interesting this year, just as an aside, and I realise we're getting out of Britain, so the listeners are probably tuning over, is the thing to watch this year from a financial and political point of view, what happens in the German general election.
Yeah,
because
when we get there.
When we get there, so that's September. But when that happens, you know, Angela Merkel so far has been writing all these checks. Will she be there? Will she not? Her party's popular, but her coalition partners aren't. So will she be in government? If she pulls the plug afterwards, and there's been a reticence of the Germans to pull the plug on the Euro project, but if she starts to let southern European countries go, no second bailouts of Portugal and things, then actually you may well start seeing a dissolution of banking and the economic and the Eurozone. Later this year, that for me, the political event of this year isn't the elections in 2 weeks, it's actually the German election. That could be the one with the most ramifications.
And one of the things I've noticed is that there's been a rise of a new party in Germany, hasn't there, which is a more nationalistic party, which is really talking about having absolutely nothing to do with the rest of Europe economically.
Yeah, you sort of do tend to get this swing to right-wing populism, but Germany, because of the way that it is and the system that it's got, these parties do spring up and disappear and spring up and disappear. I suppose wish them well, sort of, but I think the writing will be on the wall. We'll have to see in September. I don't think they're going to make a breakthrough.
Okay, on to one of this week's specific stories. That's a bit of general chat there. Npower admits paying no corporation tax for 3 years. RWE Npower's chief executive Paul Mazzara told the Energy and Climate Change Select Committee that the company had not paid corporation tax after he was asked by Labour MP Ian Lavery if he could confirm how much it had paid in 2009, 2010 and 2011. He said, so we will not have paid corporation tax in those 3 years. Effectively, we've invested £5 billion in the last 5 years building power plants, creating jobs, creating employment and helping to keep the lights on. If we'd not made that investment, we would not have the deductibility that we would be allowed. That's a simple accounting UK rule, Mark. This is a massive company, but they're paying no tax.
Yeah, but you look at why they're paying no tax, essentially because they've done a massive investment. And what you do is you're allowed to write off the capital investment against your tax receipts. Now, we need to be careful here. Yeah, they didn't pay corporation tax, but it's not because they weren't putting money in the British economy. We need to be very careful. We're not bashing companies for doing that. And if you look at what's happening in British corporations at the moment, there's about £730 billion held by the big companies in Britain. Okay, £730 billion in reserves that they simply sat on. we, whichever party, left or right, whatever hue, is going to want that as much of that 730 million flowing into the economy as capital investment as we can possibly get. But let's be honest, those companies are then going to write that capital investment off against their corporation tax rates. But the money is still flowing into the economy. I think this is the problem. You're trying to argue an economic point of view, but you're fighting the need for a cheap headline.
Yeah, okay, but it says here in this article, the Press Association, that they've had a 34% rise in profits for 413 million. Well, how come they're not being taxed on that?
Again, it's because the amount that they put in to the economy as capital investment.
But they've also increased electricity prices and gas prices by about 9%.
I'm not going to approve of that. Let's be quite clear on this. I do think they've increased gas prices enormously. I think their rise in profits makes that unjustifiable, and I'm not going to try and defend that. But when we're trying to argue economics, we need to be honest with ourselves. They may not have been paying corporation tax, but that's because they're making capital investment. Money is still flowing into the economy. It's not like they're trying to dodge the British economy. They're using the accountancy rules. They're not being criminal. You could argue, and I think quite rightly, that actually with their rise in profits, they shouldn't have put up prices. And I think that is absolutely wrong. But they, on this one issue, on the corporation tax,
Aren't they putting up prices simply because they can and no one's going to stop them?
This is one thing. I really want to see the result of the investigation because you always see it's like a shoal of piranha, isn't it? That as soon as one utility company puts up its prices, they all follow in fairly quick succession. And it's like when you see the fuel pumps. You know, if you're at Esso, BP or whatever, one of them puts up prices, the rest tend to spike and follow suit as well.
Sounds like a good argument against any of this privatisation, doesn't it?
No, because actually in the public sector it didn't really work either. No, but they need to be investigated.
Well, you didn't get 10% increases in gas and electricity prices when it was in the public sector, did you?
Before my time, my friend.
Martin?
Well, I think this is exactly the problem, is that we've had a whole generation where there are certain things that we can't talk about, like having a nationalised energy sector, which of course we can't possibly have, so we've got to discuss it in terms of more competition. We've got six companies here, and as you rightly pointed out, sort of textbook stuff, their pricing policy is collusive. Oh, this is what you would expect from the textbook. And this, of course, is the reason why there is the ultimate, free market economics is incoherent, because most markets are not, in fact, free markets. They are oligopolies of this kind, especially when there's massive investment involved, as we've been talking about investment. Now, in actual fact, you can run these things either in the public or the private sector, but if you run them in the private sector, then you've got to have regulation, because the market itself will just profiteer without regulation. Mm. And I think, you've
well, there is regulation, Martin, yes, but the regulators have said, yes, it's okay.
It's not sufficiently tough, because if it was sufficiently tough, you would tax away their profits to virtually zero. And, of course, a nationalised energy industry can supply to its customers at marginal cost, because it doesn't have to make
For your benefit,
profit.
Mark, I've got my little Margaret Thatcher timeline, which I put together last weekend. And British Gas was privatised in December 1986 under Margaret Thatcher, and the Electricity Act, which began the complicated privatisation of electricity, all except nuclear, was passed in 1990 under her watch. So before that, this was all in the public sector, and there was no way that they would be allowed to get away with raising prices by 10%.
Well, the thing is, they need to be regulated even now, because I'd like to see there be some kind of link between the price of the gas or the oil or whatever they're using, and coal, nuclear, whatever they're using, and the price they charge. There has to be that link, because you can't have these kind of rises. You know, we're all sitting there, and we've had a blisteringly cold, if you don't mind me just mashing the two words together there, a blisteringly cold winter, and it's just run on and on. And there are families out there, and there are families in my ward that are almost sitting there going, well, we can't afford to have the heating on, so therefore we've got 18 jumpers on, blankets and everything else.
But, but these guys at Empower, sitting around their board table, saying, well, we're going to increase our prices, what can we get away with, guys?
Well, that's what it is. I mean, this is one of the things that, if now, and it's not just in Empower, but it's also when it comes to things like petrol as well, that if, say, the Chancellor tomorrow knocked 40p off fuel duty, I bet the prices wouldn't drop for long, because they've worked out we will pay what we are paying now. There needs to be an increased regulation on these kind of utility companies.
Can we bank that? Because I think this is the common ground that which we can find. Because ultimately, really, really tight regulation ends up being public control, which is how these
You can't have you can't have it excessively tight, because you do need some freedom.
But the point is, if you can have it excessively tight, there are other countries in the world, say Norway for example, that do have publicly run energy companies. They just do. They've never had anything else. Now, in other words, there are other options outside the Thatcher universe. And of course, we've had a whole generation, including with New Labour in power, where what are perfectly legitimate options, having your electricity industry, for example, run by the government, which is happens in many parts of the world, it just doesn't happen here, are unthinkable. And that is the problem. We've now got ourselves into a situation where we can't think perfectly ordinary thoughts.
Okay, on to our next story. Jobless Leap. This is from, I'm sure, Mark's favourite paper he gets every morning, The Morning Star. Jobless Leap.
Another well-balanced publication.
Jobless Leap, fitting tribute to Thatcher, they say. Unemployment surged to 2.56 million in a stark demonstration of disastrous Thatcherite economic policies today. And this is what they say, that workers have also suffered a big cut in real wages, with average earnings up just 0.8% over the year to February. Well, actually, what they're saying here, Mark, is in a way going back to that story about Empower, because if your wages are only going up roughly 1% and your electricity and gas prices are going up 9%, you know, you're actually having a wage cut all the time,
aren't you? Yeah, I have to say, I mean, obviously the readers aren't looking at the language of this, but it is a rather spiteful piece, considering that was the day she was cremated and everything else. So, okay, ignoring that. Yeah, the unemployment rose. It's the first time it's done so in about 18 months. And it's happened, and it's deeply unfortunate, and my deepest sympathies, genuinely, because it's horrific. I've been unemployed. When you become unemployed, it is a massive confidence blow. There are jobs out there, but there are so many people going for them. But we cannot ignore the fact that there are more people in work now than there have ever been at any point in British history. You can argue that some of them aren't doing the job they want, or that they're doing two part-time jobs, or they're self-employed,
or whatever. Or one part-time job and on benefits.
It could well be. It could be a mix. It can be an entire cocktail of them.
Well, I mean, this is the Joseph Rowntree Foundation about 3 weeks ago came out with I found an absolutely riveting report explaining that there's actually 6.5 million people out there looking for full-time work right now at any one time. The only jobs that many people can get are these small part-time jobs. So we may have lots of people in work, but we're still hearing from these figures from the National Office for Statistics saying unemployment has risen by 70,000 in the quarter up to February, now to reach 2.5 million.
Yeah, but that is still down from where it was a few years ago.
Martin?
It did spike. Let's not get around that. But
yeah, well, I mean, what the significance of this may be, and of course it's only 1 month's figures, as it were, or one quarter's figures, is that we're now on unemployment is what economists call a lagging indicator. So unemployment starts to go up when you're just, you know, after other things have happened. So in other words, I would argue that the economy running on empty, we've been basically driving on empty since the coalition came to power. Now, I'm not saying it would have been that much different if Labour had been in power, but on the other hand,
wouldn't we have conked out by now?
I think, for two and a half years, running on empty, we wouldn't, in actual fact. What should have happened was that pretty much what the Labour Party was going to do was just carry on steering into the skid that we were in. In actual fact, what will probably happen eventually is that it will all crash. That's what will happen. And don't forget, we're doing this. We've already got 2.5 million unemployed. Even though unemployment has been going down, don't forget the population has risen by quite a lot, and that makes quite a bit of a difference. And any country can have a larger or a smaller population, depending on changes that go on in terms of immigration or births or whatever. Now, the problem is that we've got no demand in the economy. We were talking about investment earlier, but and 730 million, I think you mentioned, in the hands of the corporations. If I was running a corporation, I'm not going to invest if there is no demand in the economy. And because the policy is to cut demand out of the economy, and this, of course, squeezes.
Okay, Martin,
down,
I think you made your point. I think you made your point there, Mark.
Actually, several points on this. Yeah. Right. You're saying it's lagging behind. Unemployment started falling in 2011. Okay? So unemployment was rising after the crash that happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it doesn't quite follow your lag. We need to see if this becomes a trend or if it's a spike. We've had 1 month's results.
I fear it may be a trend.
It might be a spike. I would hope. Let us hope it's a spike and be fearful it's a trend. I think we can agree on that language. Look, but then you mentioned the 730 billion, which I raised earlier. That is how much is being held in reserves. Now, that is round about 48% of GDP. Now, during the 90s, when these kind of reserves were run up, they actually only held 20 to 25%. What we have to do as a government, as a country, is find ways to encourage those businesses to invest. Now, you talked about Empower earlier on, and we talked about it, about their capital investment. I think what we have to do is actually allow businesses to make even larger capital investment write-offs against their tax to try and get this 730 billion, or at least some of it, flowing into the economy. And we have to try and do that. The government doesn't have the money. And whether it was a Labour government or it's the current coalition government, that money is not there. Because you can't... Money doesn't grow on trees. They're borrowing that money from somebody. And if they don't think they have the confidence in us, they're never going to be able to borrow it.
Okay, let's try and unpack this logically. I mean, the money.
We don't need to start doing that now.
No, I think it's important because that's what the people need to hear in this situation, don't they? Not your boo sucks. You're in the wrong. We're in the right. Let's get to where we can agree. Now that money is not going to be invested while the demand in the economy is being chopped back. That's my first point. Second point is that the investments that are going to be made will ultimately have to be made by the public sector. And you say, well, where's the money going to come from? Well, there's two ways that the money's going to come. One, we are going to have to massively reboot the tax system, back to how it used to be in the 1950s, when the top rate of tax, for example, was 90-odd percent, both in the US and in Britain, under conservative government.
That's ridiculous.
You think so? Wait until you've had a crash. You've had a crash, and the unemployment that we're looking at now is through the roof, and then we will see. Now, obviously, this is not what the Labour front bench is saying, but I'm not the Labour front bench.
Okay, can we just move on to a local story, please, which looks at the illustrates
can
how...
Can I not reply
actually,
on that tax?
Go on, get on with it.
Okay, just one thing on this. Okay, when there was a 40% top rate of tax, you had 16,000 millionaires in this country paying that tax. When it went to 50, that dropped to 7,000. These are wealthy people that just move. What you have to do is tax them just enough that they can continue to stay here and pay tax, and not so much that they just disappear off with the money.
I'm not saying this should go to 90%.
But I'm just saying it used to be. This entire argument is lost by those that want to punish the wealthy, which, you know, they've got to pay their fair share, but we also have to apply some economic logic to it. We want as many wealthy people in this country paying tax at a rate that they will continue to do so, and not want to disappear
into a tax haven.
Many
of them don't, that they have their money in tax havens anyway.
Well, no, look at the figures. You had 16,000 millionaires, you increase the top rate of tax, you had 7,000. I'd rather have 16,000 paying slightly less than 7,000 paying more. Anyway, okay, we can go to local.
Financial advisor's success shows no sign of slowing. And by some amazing miracle, I managed to pull this off of the new Bristol Evening Post website, which is really very, very difficult to navigate. The old one wasn't exactly marvellous, but this new one, it's almost impossible to find any stories on there. And they're certainly not appearing on Google News.
I gave up
like that.
I went back to the old one.
It's really, I mean, it seems to, every new page you go to find the new stories has the same exact stuff on for about half the way through the page. Anyway, try again, Evening Post. Maybe next week you'll get it sorted out. But the success story of one of Bristol's biggest and most profitable firms is showing no signs of slowing down. Hargreaves Lansdowne, launched in a Clifton bedroom 30 years ago, employs 750 people and is a member of the FTSE 100 Club. Now the firm, which specialises in advising small investors, has announced it's managing £35.1 billion worth of people's savings, an increase of £4.7 billion in 3 months. A series of records tumbled over the last 3 months, which saw revenue soar by 216.6 million, Martin.
Well, let's think back to the bailout of the banks, which we were discussing earlier. If Gordon Brown had not bailed out the banks, would Hargreaves Lansdowne be making all these profits? And the answer is very definitely no. So where did the money come from?
What would have happened?
Ultimately, it came from the British taxpayer underpinning the stock market, which allows them to make their profit. Once you've gone away from a free market economy, the distribution of profits is not actually based on free market principles. So in other words, these people are, in fact, indirectly public employees. And the maximum amount that they should be earning is, in fact, what top public employees earn, which is supposed less than the Prime Minister. Now, this sounds as if it's rhetoric and exaggerated, but the fact of the situation is the financial market is now way out of line with real values in the economy, and this is going to be a crash.
Is it, Martin, to make a point there, Mark, because in a way the taxpayer, Gordon Brown, is propping up Hargreaves Lansdowne?
I don't think Gordon Brown's propping up anything at the moment. No, I'm sorry. Let's just take the vitriol out of this one for a minute. We have a Bristol company that's doing well. It's employing people in the city. It's a success story, and yet suddenly we turned it into a disaster. Well done, Hargreaves Lansdowne. Long may your success continue. They've done very well. They seem to be acting responsibly, but obviously you don't see what happens behind the scenes. But they're a good company, and I say well done to them. And I really think that we need to get away from anyone with any money being evil type of mindset that we do see.
I don't think
we're
necessarily saying that. What Martin was making was that actually the Hargreaves Lansdowne probably would not exist now if it wasn't for the bailout by Gordon Brown in 2008. Let me make this point to you, Martin. This is not a high street bank, right? This is an investment bank. This has been separated from the the high street sector. This has already gone through that process that many people up in London are saying needs to happen, and they're doing really well at it.
Well, they haven't gone through the process because they never were a bank in the first place. I mean, although Goldman Sachs, of course, made themselves classified as a bank so that they could take TARP bailout funds. Now, you can't have it both ways. The financial sector is essentially now based on two things keeping it afloat. One is taxpayers and the other is the drug cartels. Now, indirectly, all the profit made in the financial sector, all of it, and we're talking about the financial sector now, not about NPower, which actually produces something, all of the profit is actually dependent upon government spending. That government spending comes from taxes. Those taxes are what makes your deficit. Now, ultimately, of course, we then have to borrow the money back from those people, and they insist on having conditions like austerity on it. Ultimately, nothing is going to happen until there is a crash, and that is the market solution. The von Mises Institute and the serious free marketeers are saying there will be a crash, and it's a good
Martin,
thing.
Martin, you're back to the crash again. Let me respond.
If the banks had crashed without the Gordon Brown bailout, no, Hargreaves Lansdowne wouldn't be there. But I would imagine virtually every other form of economic institution would also have gone to the wall. We need to look. I reluctantly, because I don't believe in state bailouts, but we had to do it. Can we just accept that and move on? And I'm not going to buy the fact.
But if you move
that,
on.
Oh, hold on. I've listened to the pity ditty. I'm going to reply.
Yeah.
I'm not going to buy the fact that British banking is built on the backs of the drug cartels either. I'm sorry.
That's nonsense.
Now, Hargreaves Lansdowne, okay, is a success story for the city. They're advising small investors. They're doing it well. They're doing it responsibly. So it's well done, Stephen Lansdowne. Well done, Peter Hargreaves. Long may your success continue.
Martin, can't you just take your hat off to Stephen Lansdowne and Peter Hargreaves?
No, because...
Because they do seem to have done quite well with a lot. Many Bristolians have put their savings with these guys, and they're doing actually very well with it.
The point I'm making is a logical point, which is that once you have bailed the banks out, the distribution of profits, wages, and everything else becomes malinvestment, according to the Hayekian view, to the von Mises view. So, in other words, these profits are not real profits; they're profits based on malinvestment. Now, the way to get malinvestment out of the system, this is all in the free market textbook, is you allow the system to collapse. Now, we've been trying to keep it afloat for 4 years using a socialist method. That socialist method is about to fail, and the banking system is going to collapse.
We need to get away from socialist, capitalist, left and right, whatever ideology you want. The bailout had to happen because the alternative was worse.
Once you've had the bailout, you're in a socialist society. The alternative was worse.
Okay, however much money is in the private or public sector, it's not going to be able to build a time machine and go back and alter it.
No.
There's no point howling in the wilderness. We have to accept the world as it is. The bailout has happened because, sadly, it needed to happen. Now, again, Hargreaves Lansdowne, well done. Let's go to the next story.
Okay, benefits cap. Thank you, Mark. The trial begins in London. This is the effect of all of this, of course. A cap on the annual benefits people can receive begins on Monday in a policy that's being trialled in parts of the capital. The cap being introduced in four London boroughs, Croydon, Bromley, Haringey and Enfield, will see couples and single parents receive no more than £500 a week in benefits. The limit for a single person is £350, although there are some exemptions. National implementation of the cap will begin in July, and the policy is scheduled to come fully into force by the end of September. Mark, this is the effect of some of this. I mean, even though in some of these places in London, £500 is not going to cover your living costs because rents are so high.
I fully support the benefits cap. And I can't believe we hadn't had one before. Let's be clear on this. That's £26,000, which actually is a job of £35,000. That's what it is. So we're allowing people an equivalent income on the state of £35,000.
Well, isn't most of this money going to landlords, actually, not to the people that are receiving the benefit?
Again, if you go back to free markets, if the money's not there, maybe they'll charge a lower rent. You know, have we inflated the prices in London because we've been so generous with what we're prepared to give out? Now, I'm sorry, there are families struggling in Bristol that are nowhere near an income of pre-tax 35,000, and I think they are going to be agog, aghast, annoyed that actually their hard work and them paying their taxes has allowed this kind of level of support. The welfare state should always be a safety net. It should support those in need, but
Are the landlords in need? Because that's what my point I'm making here is most of this money is going to the landlords. Martin, yeah. The cap was originally expected to save £275 million a year from the welfare bill.
Well, in terms of the big money we were talking about earlier, it's saving money. It's an ideological thing. It's got nothing to do with saving the economy. Let's make that point absolutely clear. The amount of money being saved here is, you know, it's not even a banker's bonus on a Monday morning. So we're just talking about trivial amounts of money in the big scheme.
It's £270 million, Martin.
Yeah. A year from the welfare bill. I mean, that is not a large amount of money in terms of what we were talking about with the Hargreaves Lansdown earlier with their subsidised profits. A lot more. Now, the fact of the matter is that if you carry on cutting demand out of the economy by cutting benefits, by not rising them in line with inflation, by all the mechanisms that are being used, you are actually making the chances of a crash higher, not lower. In Iceland, when they jailed their bankers and didn't bail out their banks, they also increased unemployment benefits. That's because they knew about 25% of the population was probably going to end up unemployed. Those are the voters, and in Iceland the voters decide. The cynical exercise behind all of this is that the government knows very well that elections in Britain are decided in marginal constituencies by middle-income voters, so it doesn't matter what happens to these people.
I mean, no, not.
Shouldn't you be punishing the landlords and not the people who are actually homeless? Maybe homeless otherwise, Mark. No.
Look, I'm sorry. £26,000 is the benefits cap. That's £35,000 if you earned it. Okay, that is a very generous welfare state. Whether it's a paltry amount, whether it is not. Having it allowed to increase to such an extent makes a mockery of the idea of a safety net. Landlords in London will have specifically inflated their prices because they know that they can get that. And I'm afraid, as unfortunate as it is...
But that's your free market.
Yeah, I know, but this is the thing. It's a free market supported by the welfare state. So actually you need to cap benefits, you need to reduce the welfare state, and then maybe the landlords will actually reduce their rents.
Okay, final word to you, Martin.
What you need to do is build council houses, as Macmillan did in the 1950s, give everybody a low rent, courtesy of the government, which is what Conservatives used to do.
Okay. And it's funny how 13 years of Labour government, virtually no council houses were built.
Okay. I totally agree with you about that. That's totally enough. Wrong.
Philip Sands, QC, quits the Lib Dems over the corrosive secret courts bill. This is leading lawyer and former advisor to Nick Clegg has quit the Liberal Democrat Party over the leadership support for the corrosive justice and security bill. Writing in The Guardian, the professor of international law at University College London said plans for secret courts were wrong in principle and would not deliver justice. It would be used to shield government wrongdoing from the public and judicial scrutiny under conditions that are fair and just, he said. Now, Mark, this is a pretty appalling bit of legislation in anyone's book, and the Habeas Corpus Act at 1679 has been around hundreds of years. This is going to overturn that. If you find out that one of your friends or family is in jail, you'll have no actual right to find out if they ought to actually get them released or to find out what they're in there for, because the courts will be able to sit in secret.
I agree with you. I don't like this bill.
So why is your party at Westminster pushing it through?
I'll keep it short and sweet. I don't agree with this bill. I think that you have the right to face your accuser. I think courts should be in the open. Justice not only needs to be done, but needs to be seen to be done. I don't support it. And if the QC has that feeling as well, then I'm not surprised if he holds it that strongly.
Martin?
Well, I won't be surprised to find that I agree with that view too. Of course, secret justice is totally...
So why are they pushing this through? Any ideas?
I think it's to do with the security issue. I mean... There is information gathered by the intelligence services that actually if you put it into a court, you would potentially lose the intelligence asset.
Well, when was the last time you saw an intelligence officer actually go to jail for falsifying anything? Because quite a lot of the investigations that we've had over the last 4 or 5 years, including in 7/7, for example, intelligence officers were saying that these guys who committed the 7/7 bombings were clean skins. We then found out that actually intelligence officers had been following them around for years beforehand. And this really is just a way of keeping those people and any evidence against them out of court and out of the public domain.
Tony, I'm afraid you're probably not going to get much of a conversation on this article simply because I actually agree with you. Okay. I don't think that secret courts are a good idea under any circumstances.
Well, what worries me most about secret courts is that the intelligence services, for example, may use secret courts to hide things like Harun Aswat, who is the Americans are trying to extradite for running jihadi camps in Oregon. He's actually in Britain, in Broadmoor. He's got paranoid schizophrenia, apparently, named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind for 7-7, but then put in administrative detention because John Loftus, who is a former Attorney General in the US, said that he was
FBI special prosecutor,
I get me wrong, said that he's a British agent. Now, in other words, what can happen is intelligence services can use secret courts to cover up their own misdeeds, and that, of course, is why they're a no-no.
Yeah, so it's Ken Clark who's put this all together. He seems to be the biggest threat to justice in this country, not anybody else. It's unbelievable.
In fairness, Ken, he and I disagree on some things, namely Europe, but... Ken Clark is a good man. I just think he's misguided on this bill. I think he is motivated by the need to use intelligence assets to get criminals. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that. But as far as I'm concerned, justice has to be seen to be done. And on this issue, he is wrong. And I think when it goes through, you could end up with the European arrest warrant syndrome, where actually a well-meaning piece of legislation is being used very wrongly to punish those that didn't actually need punishing. And no, I cannot support that kind of policy.
Okay, Bristol has a high cancer mortality rate and too few MMR jabs. Actually, it's the MMR jabs that we seem to be so interested at the moment because of this outbreak in Swansea of measles. This is also a Bristol professor has called, this is another headline in the Post by Vicky Mathias, measles outbreak shows why we must get our children vaccinated. A Bristol professor has called on parents to learn lessons from Swansea, get their children vaccinated against measles. The outbreak of the disease in South Wales City has now reached about 600 cases. Well, the reason that there's a lot of doubt about the MMR vaccine is because of a doctor going by the name of Andrew Wakefield. And we're going to hear his version of all this now, as he gave a statement on the internet, because we haven't really heard very much at all from him elsewhere.
I did not seek out this latest media maelstrom. It came about because of an outbreak of measles in South Wales, in the United Kingdom, for which I have been blamed by Her Majesty's government. So I did not seek this out, but now it seems that I have been denied the opportunity to redress the allegations that have been made against me by members of the government, by members of public health, and that is clearly unacceptable. So legitimate debate about the safety of MMR vaccine and the origin of the measles epidemic in Wales have now been effectively blocked by the government insisting that the British media do not give me airtime, do not allow me to respond. Back in 1996-97, I was made aware of children developing autism, regressive autism, following exposure, in many cases, to the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Such was my concern about the safety of that vaccine that I went back and reviewed every safety study, every pre-licensing study of the MMR vaccine and other measles-containing vaccines before they were put into children and after. And I was appalled with the quality of that science. It really was totally below par, and that has been reiterated by other authoritative sources since. I compiled my observations into a 200-page report, which I am seeking to put online once I get the permission of my lawyers. And that report was the basis of my impression that MMR vaccine was inadequately tested for safety, certainly compared with the single vaccines, and therefore that was the basis of my recommendation in 1998 at the press conference that parents should have the option of the single vaccines. All I could do as a parent is to say, what would I do for my child? That was the only honest answer I could give. My position on that has not changed.
That was Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Now, Mark Weston, it's been very much presented as a sort of fait accompli that MMR is great, but as we just heard from Dr. Wakefield there, people aren't being given the option of having the single vaccine. They're having to have all three at once. And also, when this MMR was originally introduced in the late 1980s, of the three different types of MMR vaccine, two of them had to be almost immediately withdrawn because they were actually causing, you know, really damaging symptoms in children.
Am I replying to that? I'm not quite sure. I'm not a doctor. I don't genuinely know. Dr. Andrew Wakefield, when he introduced his evidence, it has been pretty much roundly condemned by the rest of the establishment. I'm afraid when it comes to medical issues, I am going to take the majority view. I don't know whether he is to blame for the Swansea outbreak, but I think his casting doubt on the MMR has prevented people that should have been vaccinated from being vaccinated. What's been interesting in Swansea, though, is there are people that have not had the MMR jab because they were advised against it, or they believed Dr. Wakefield's evidence, but there are also a large number of people that were told they needed to have it but then forgot to have it. And I think we need to take aware of that. Maybe it needs to be better communication to people, are reminded they have to do it or they should do it.
Just a minute, because I mean the point I'm trying to make here is, why can't parents just decide, I want the measles vaccine, I don't want this this sort of super multi vaccine with all these different substances in it?
It's quite amusing, because parental choice is vital, but what tends to happen is if they're not given the vaccine, then they blame the government, and if the government forces them to, then they blame the government. I think that there's a situation here where we're always looking for someone to blame for it. I think it is ultimately a parental choice for MMR, but I think it should definitely be encouraged.
But what about parental choice over just having a single vaccine? Why can't parents choose to do that?
I'm afraid I genuinely don't know enough about this.
Martin?
Well, it's probably because it's more expensive to do it that way, and we're also, you know, ultimately these things come down to money.
No, the reason you don't have a choice is because the government has banned the importation of the single vaccines. They're saying the only vaccine that parents are allowed to have is the multiple MMR one.
Why have they banned
and
it?
when those original MMR vaccines were introduced, there were three different types, and two of them were found out to actually be damaging children.
Listen, I'm not going to argue with you, Tony, because a bit like our friend here, I am not a doctor either. I listen to the debate, and I try. If I had children, I would be trying to make my mind up. I won't jump to conclusions because I don't know enough about it.
I mean, I've got a 2.5-year-old, and yeah, MMR. I'm going to take it. I'm going to go with, when it comes to a medical decision about my daughter's health, I'm going to go with the majority view. And my daughter, I think she's had the MMR already. So,
I mean, one of the problems, isn't it, Martin, that Tony Blair actually refused to say whether he'd got his son vaccinated.
Well, I don't remember that, but it may be part of it. Yes.
Okay, well,
excellent. We found a way to blame Tony Blair for everything. I like this show. We should do it more often.
Okay.
An easy ride here, I can assure you.
Martin, on this, just on the basic principle, shouldn't parents just be able to decide to have just the measles vaccination on its own?
No, because unfortunately, like a lot of decisions in life, like not to wear a seatbelt, for example, are you still going to expect the National Health Service to put your face back together? And the answer is no, you wear a seatbelt, otherwise we're not paying to put your face back together.
Okay, Martin, well, thank you. We're coming up now.
I've never heard of that analogy.
Coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest you heard there, Deputy Leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council and Councillor for Henbury, Mark Weston, not an MP.
Not yet, anyway.
After the news, the Green Party are in Mayor Ferguson's cabinet, but Labour aren't. Ooh. Gus Hoyt will be here to explain what exactly he's doing for us and his party. And, of course, Bilderberg comes to Britain in Watford, it seems, in June.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, the uncle of the suspect in the Boston bombings has urged him to hand himself in. Jahar Tsarnaev, originally from Chechnya, has been described by police as armed and dangerous. Ruslan Sani says...